next case is 237947, Ojanika Ikadillo versus Statter.
It please the court.
Hang on. Let's let the commotion settle down a little bit. It looks like there's a lot of activity in the back of the room. I want you to have our undistracted attention when the time comes. I'll ask you while we're waiting, though. Is it Ofadili?
Ofadila, Your Honor.
Yes,
I represent the appellant in this case, Dr. Ojanika Ikadillo. This is one of the cases.
I'm sorry to do this to you. There's just still a lot of commotion. I'll give you the signal and we'll restart your time at 7 minutes. I didn't realize there was a whole other pack coming into the courtroom to hear your arguments. All right, Mr. Ofadila.
Okay.
Floor is yours.
Yes. Your Honor, sir, this is one of those cases that, as counsel, one looks at the facts and as presented to the court below and gets this type of decision and wonders what type of facts ever could somebody bring to get remedy in a federal court. My client was the only black person in her class. And based on the rules of Montefiore Medical Center, in the first year, she got meets expectations for promotion, the first fourth year. In the second fourth year, she got meets expectations to be promoted with all the evaluations, very good. Even Dr. Statter, who said she did not believe the grades, the evaluations given to my client, she only believed that given by Jacoby. Jacoby gave her 4.67 of 5 in medical knowledge. She testified she didn't believe it because she gave my client 1, which is the worst possible claim in medical knowledge. Because she assigned, she testified to in the record that it's the chair of the milestone committee who assigns the milestone, and then when they go, they discuss it. This is in 3 to 24. That's her testimony. And Dr. Ikedilo said she was there when she assigned that milestone. That is the reason why we're here. Because if she did what she was supposed to do, use the new innovation evaluations to assign the milestone, my client will have gotten another residency in another place, will have graduated. There will have been no lawsuit. But going to on the motion for summary judgment, going to what the district judge ruled, that my client could not make out a prima facie case, I believe that the district judge was wrong. First of all, my client was the only person required to get 30 percentile in upsight. We have a Jewish, Dr. Statter is Jewish. There's a Jewish resident who got 0, 1 and 0, much less than my client, who was promoted each year. And there were others who were not black. So, and that is important. And the court should recognize that if the standard started applied to my client will apply to her, she would never have become a doctor. She got 16 and 20% in upside during her time. She failed the board. But for my client, who is black, she has to impose a standard that she herself did not meet for her to move on.
So can I ask one of the things if this case were solely based on the absite scores and the differential treatment relative to the absite scores, that that may be what this case is. But I understood that there is the reason that the Absite scores became important was because of questions about your client's clinical performance, and that's why she wasn't advanced from the fourth year to the fifth year the first time around. And that became the reason why the Absite scores took on greater significance. Am I misreading the record?
Yes, you're not. You see, the most important thing is that this Dr. Stata signed in January that my client, the first PG, four PG, she said that my client met expectations. The advisor, Dr. Stone, said that my client met expectations. And then my client was given a contract. She signed it. I sent it back. And Dr. Sata waited for the contract, for the upside score for the year to come. When that upside score came, my client's score was low. Then she wrote, at that time my client was applying for a fellowship. Then she wrote, the email is there. She wrote to the other professor, said, don't give my client a recommendation to get a fellowship.
Can we back up to some of the clinical evaluations? Because you said there were no problems in the first year. I think that's roughly true. You said there were no problems in the second year. But in the second half of the second year, she's getting reviews that say she seemed distracted and not motivated. She needed to work on her timeliness. She was many times late to the OR and the clinic. She needs to work on her preparation. Another Dr. Papalazova said that your client's technical skills in the operating room are below the level of a PGY2. And this is, she's still getting passed through to the third year, but it seems to me there was a reason to be concerned, notwithstanding that she was rated at least a 3 on a numerical scale, but there's a lot of criticism even that year, and then it escalates in the third year.
Well, Your Honor, it's important to know Dr. Stephen Kahn, who has been the chair and the director, even in Yale and many other very reputable schools, said, we have that expert report, that people get good and bad evaluations, comments. Even Dr. Stata admitted, yes, people get bad comments. And she, she herself will tell every student to improve in her comments. The problem we have here is that we only have the comments on the plaintiff. Even Dr. Van Smith, who just came because she used Van Smith and Muscarella, people who just come to the program. That's the people she uses for her hatchet jobs. Dr. Van Smith gave bad evaluation to others. And I asked Dr. Stata, do you know whether Dr. Van Smith gave bad evaluation to others? She said she doesn't know. She knows, but of course she wouldn't admit it. My client says that this doctor says she gave bad evaluations to everybody. So the issue is the picking out, you know. The issue is that it's only when it's against her. All the good comments was not used. And more importantly, all the bad evaluations that were used to justify this decision, where each one was made after the advice, once my client starts an administrative procedure, Dr. Stata commissions this one. So you cannot find one that, at least one that happened after, before the administration, at least in the second year, the first year. Once she starts an appeal or says she doesn't agree with the decision of Stata, then Stata commissions this. And let me just say, which is very important, if I have opportunity, I'll address them. A person acting in good faith do not truncate the administrative process. It's very clear in our brief. The reason she repeated the first PG1, PG4 year was for insubordination. Insubordination, not doing surgeries with Dr. Scott Melvin, but deliberately, insidiously, in an email, and we have it here, Stata said, do it with Akin Murray. That's what the House Committee wants. And she did it. Stata goes back and reports that she refused to do it with Scott Melvin. So, and there are so many of them I can point out. For example, with her termination, she was told when you get to each college, meet the professors who are your mentors. She did. She met three. And then, you know what Stata said? She didn't ask my client. She said she sent email to those doctors. Only one responded. The other two did not respond. So she assumed that my client didn't and terminated her. So this is, and there's more, many of these things. Somebody who is not acting based on race will not single my client out. We gave other examples. A woman who is white, who had treated a patient for 3 days straight and the patient died, he was asked to discuss the death. She said no. My client who saw the patient on the first day of admission was told to. She said, but I haven't seen the patient for 4 days. And she was told, this is academic failure, you will be terminated. Another person who is not black was overslept. And my client was blamed. She couldn't be relieved.
I'm curious, the another fact that distinguishes your client from many of these other people is her bearing children twice during the course of her residency. And I'm curious why you're emphasizing the racial discrimination rather than inferring that this was discrimination based on her pregnancy status.
Well, we also believe that it's also discrimination based on pregnancy status, and we are of course agreeing that the readmission requirements were discriminatory. And let me just say, two times Dr. Stata has tried to terminate my client. Each time they said she didn't have enough evidence. The second time, the standard results, when it's arbitrary and capricious, the school found that the termination was arbitrary and capricious, not based on any evidence. And the rule was, the issue presented was her readmission. Then, within that 2 months, when she was, in fact, there was an email, Stata wrote her, when you expect your baby, she said November. No, the decision came that November when she gave birth to a baby. She has to pass USLM 3. She has to pass upside above 30%. You know, so.
Mr. Al-Fadil, I sort of lost track of the time here, but you should probably wind it up. We'll hear from you again.
Okay. All right. As we said, made clear in our brief, another thing is attached the people admitted by Stata. Only one black person. Categorical.
Okay, I think.
Then you see all the people given categorical were Jewish and white. Admission. The evidence is there. She became director in 2013.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Field.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Joseph Field from the law firm of Littler Mendelson. I represent the defendants appellees in this case, Montefiore Medical Center and Dr. Statter, among the other individual defendant named physicians here. So we have two district court judges, Magistrate Judge Netburn and District Judge Abrams, both reached the same conclusion here, that the plaintiff failed to meet her burden on summary judgment to show but for plaintiff's race, that Dr. Statter and others, defendants, would not have required her, Dr. Iccadillo, to remediate her postgraduate year 4, and then following that, to terminate her from the surgical residency program at Montefiore.
But our review's de novo, right?
Yes, that is correct.
So why don't you tell us what you think, why you think the record warrants our concluding, too, that summary judgment is warranted?
Okay, so essentially the decision here was based upon real-time feedback from more than a dozen physicians, not just at Montefiore, but also at Jacoby Medical Center, which is a sister hospital that operates with Montefiore in its surgical residency program. So these decisions were based on objective criteria, such as what Your Honors had already recognized, to be one of the key issues here, which is the plaintiff's continuing poor abscite exam. So she scored between 1% and 7th percentile on the abside exam.
But that was true of others in the program as well, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. So the issue
and her performance was pretty abysmal, but then that was also true. It wasn't that she just missed the 30% cutoff. she had single-digit scores many times. But then that was also true of other people in the program.
Right. So counsel has mentioned some of the other people, and this is addressed in the district court decision, both in the report and recommendation, as well as a decision adopting that. So we have the similar situated standard under Shumway, and you have to show that these comparators are similarly situated in all material respects. So, for example, I'm not sure what the fact that Dr. Statter is Jewish or that these other residents are Jewish. This is not a religious discrimination case, but in any event, the other white residents who received poor APSIT scores did not have any of the other, we say comorbidities in effect, other factors such as poor reviews by, attending physicians. And
so they didn't have those. I guess, is it that the evidence shows they didn't, or we just don't know because
they did not? And, Your Honor, if you...
So we actually have records of...
Well, there's records, but there's also Dr. Statter, who is a program director. She submitted an affidavit on summary judgment. And let me just emphasize...
I'm sorry, I'm getting stuck on this point, but just to make sure I understand. In terms of what the record in this case reflects about the other factors, the clinical performance of the other potential comparators, are you saying that the record gives us information from which we can conclude they are not comparable, or are you saying that plaintiff has the burden here and the record is devoid of evidence that can tell us that they are comparable?
Well, plaintiff does have the burden, but we also have personal evidence, which is firsthand knowledge from Dr. Statter, the program director, about these other residents and comparing their performance.
I take it that the records of all of those other students exist and that they could have been sought in discovery by the plaintiff, right?
Yes.
Were they sought?
No.
Okay.
Those records were not.
So those records are not, in fact, in the record before us. And you're saying, on the one hand, there is some evidence in the form of Dr. Statter, who reviewed those people who said they're not comparable. And the plaintiff has nothing to contradict that. Is that the state of play, or am I misstating your position?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And let me add one other thing I just wanted to mention, is that appellant's counsel did not include Dr. Statter's reply declaration as part of the record, but that is in the district court, and I do reference it in my brief. But if there are any questions as to some of the arguments that the plaintiff made in their reply brief, some of them are addressed in Dr. Statter's reply declaration, which is document number 92 in the district court. And that reply declaration is, I believe, 18-page and has exhibits to that as well. So, as Your Honor pointed out, these problems did not come out of nowhere. They existed early on in the plaintiff's second year. And these are not just the APSIT scores or the fact that the plaintiff did not pass the USMLE Step 3, which is also a requirement to be promoted and to graduate from the program. But they go to her competency as a physician.
Yeah, but, if you look at the scores that she got, I'm looking at page A1888, which is a chart of the plaintiff's scores. Now, I recognize that these scores are just numbers. I recognize that at least in law schools where I have taught, a B may not represent particularly outstanding performance or even above average performance at one time it might. Nevertheless, when you look at the scores, which apparently were important enough to be tallied this way, the plaintiff got lower scores, sometimes significantly lower scores than her peer average. But it's still, her scores range from a low of ones, in some cases from some people, to a 5 by others. The average, her average comes out to, you know, things like 3.8 or 3.4 in one category over 4. They're lower than the average of her peers, but there's nothing here that remotely suggests that she was at the bottom of what her peers were.
No, one of the things that Dr. Statter does talk about in her declaration, her moving declaration, is that numbers can be deceptive. I mean, mm-hmm. getting a 3, if you're in a 1 to 5 and you get a 3, meeting expectations, counsel talked about that. But what's important from the standpoint of the program director and from the residency program itself is looking at substantive comments. Saying someone is a pleasure to work with or is doing fine is different than looking at comments and saying that she struggles laparoscopically or that she cannot do a below-the-knee amputation or things of that nature, which are in the record from, again, numerous doctors. And this started with Dr. Van Smith. This was before she was put on remediation. And then the Jacoby group, which is a consensus review, and, you know, counsel has objected to that, saying, well, these people didn't work with her. And it's quite common to have a consensus review where various doctors put in their opinions. And this could be based upon doing rounds with a person. They don't have to actually operate with them to give an opinion on their performance. But those comments are pretty consistent. And what you see in those comments, is, apart from the numbers, is that Dr. Cadillo had an appalling lack of medical knowledge, putting aside scores and her operative procedures. And she admits this. I mean, this is also in the record. Dr. Cadillo says, I need to practice more. I need to study more. She recognized these things, and she didn't do it. She either didn't do it or couldn't do it. But the point is, she wanted to be a trauma surgeon. And apart from perhaps an airline pilot, there are a few professions where competency and skill are at such a forefront. So she wanted to be in this position. And just because I'm over 6 feet and I like basketball doesn't mean I can get into the NBA. So just as Dr. Cadillo had certain desires to become a surgeon, it doesn't mean that she had the capacity to do so. And again, in addition, there were due process procedures that were observed here. So at both the remediation stage and then at the termination stage, there was an ad hoc review committee. So they reviewed that, 5 or so different physicians reviewed that and allowed, in the second opportunity, yet another opportunity for Dr. Cadillo to try to redeem herself. And she could come back into the program. Reintegration was a term they used. Provided that, A, that she got at or above the 30th percentile on AB site, and B, that she took and passed the USMLE Step 3. She wasn't able to do either, and that's why the decision stood. Your Honor, if you want to hear about the statute of limitations issue, I can address that briefly. But I think
we have all those. There are a lot of issues in this case that unfolded over several procedural stages. I'm not suggesting someone doesn't have a question, but we do have the briefs.
And the one other thing I do want to point out is this is a discrimination case, so it's not a procedure case. It's not simply that, you know, Montefiore didn't follow its procedures or didn't, you know, give enough weight to this particular review or ignored something. This is what the district court looked at, was there has to be evidence of some sort of discriminatory animus, some sort of action here based on...
I suppose the breach of contract counts might actually be process claims potentially rather than discrimination claims.
Well, the breach of contract claim is really simply related to the requirement that she get at above 30% on AB site as being a breach of the House Officers Agreement, which, as Your Honor can anticipate, is a 3 or 5 page agreement, and it cannot anticipate every potential situation that may occur during a residency. And as the district court found, it is certainly reasonable and understandable that given the problems with medical knowledge that requiring Dr. Cadillo to get a 30% above an AB site was not a breach of any agreement whatsoever, because the language of that agreement gives sole discretion to the medical center to make such determinations that go to the competency of the physicians.
Well, I think we have your arguments in hand. I don't see any other questions forming, so thank you for your arguments. And we
thank
will
you, Your Honors.
Hear again from Mr. Ofadela.
Your Honor, we did request specifically for the records of all the residents in the court below. They objected on being that this is protected by education, federal education. We cannot get the records. I've been in this business 30 years. I requested that. They objected. And there's nothing on the record other than starters affidavits that others did not have problems.
But when they objected, was there any adjudication by the magistrate judge as to the validity of that objection? I mean, there are remedies for this. It happens all the time in discovery. One party asks for something. One party asks for everything. The other side says, we object to everything. Then there's some negotiation. Then eventually somebody comes to the judge and says, here are the things I still need, and they're refusing, and let's adjudicate. Did that ever happen here?
No, not on this perspective. But, Your Honor, Dr. Starter, in fact, if one takes time to read her deposition transcript.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Say that again, please.
Dr. Starter, if one takes time to read her deposition transcripts, she never, all the things she said were the procedures and the objective and have to be applied. She said, you know, the mentor, it's objective. The mentor can declare that you met expectations and stamp it is good to go. Then when it came to plaintiff, she never stood on anything, the procedures.
But on that, the yes. fact that there are subjective assessments of how effectively a surgeon is operating, that applies to everybody, right? It's a subjective assessment
yes.
for every surgeon.
Yes, but
so that wouldn't be indicative of discrimination, am I right?
No, but the problem here, Your Honor, is that she was never supervised my client. She did not believe the evaluations of those who did. In fact, general surgery and acute surgery, they gave her 5-5 and 4. General surgery gave her 5/5 on everything. She said she didn't believe that. Acute surgery gave her 4/4 for everything. She didn't believe that. Even in her final year, Jacobi trauma, as I said, gave her 4. The average they gave her, I tabulated it, was about 4/5 on everything. She didn't believe that. So if a woman who could not believe anything my client got, on what basis can we prove anything? And going back to what Starter said, in fact, her affidavit contradicted many things she said in her deposition. For example, she said she admitted Jide Ikeduku and another woman. But she did not admit them because she wasn't the program director. And talking about the consensus evaluation, it was done by her associate program director who did not supervise my client. How does a fair person bring somebody who is not part of the program, who works with her, to go and conduct a consensus evaluation where some of the people did not even work with my client?
Thank you. Thank you. Your time's up. Appreciate your arguments, both of you. We'll take this case under advisement.